Hey, everybody. Welcome to Sitting Around Talking Movies. This is part two of the 24th annual Hampton International Film Festival. We had such a great time out here that we just saw...
So many filmmakers.
And we saw so many people that we made it a two-parter. And, you know, we are live out here. And once again, I'm joined by Bill Brigoli.
Yes, it's lovely here.
And Bill McCuddy.
It stopped raining.
And
for part two.
Yes, it was raining during our interviews. We talked to so many people.
But did we go? Did we stop? No. Through rain, through sleet, through snow, just like the post office.
Right. And we've got so much great stuff.
We give.
That we decided we can't deny our listeners. We didn't want to do an hour and a half podcast. So you'll be fascinated.
Welcome back. We're talking to the newly inebriated.
There's a fascinating documentary here with very serious subject matter at the Hampton Film Festival called Marathon, the Patriots Day Bombing. And we're sitting here with two of the people from the film. We're speaking with
Patrick Downs
and Jessica Kensky,
who were two victims of the bombing. They're going to tell you their story in a moment, as well as the film.
Survivors. I don't know. What's the term you like? I don't know.
Thank
is that,
yes,
is that
survivors.
Better? Survivors?
Yes,
yeah.
Please. Thank you.
And our filmmakers are?
Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg.
Right. Who did, I don't know if you both did it, but you did the Joan Rivers, Joan Rivers documentary. Yeah. What was the name? I don't remember.
Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work.
Right, A Piece of Work with her ridiculously opulent apartment.
The last time I saw her was a screening for that. And I used to see her every year on the red carpet for the Oscars and stuff.
You should, before we get into the serious,
it's a shift
matter,
obviously in tone from
a divergence
what
for,
that,
for Annie
what
and
saying,
Ricky.
You should update that movie because there's a sequel to that coming. I mean, but anyway, let's move on. So tell us, instead of me telling everybody about the film, could you please, one of you, please explain the whole movie and what it's about, the documentary.
Well, I guess the quick version is that we were having a meeting with Sheila Nevins of HBO in April of 2015, and it was the opening day of the trial for the bomber of the Boston Marathon. And it was buried in the middle of the New York Times, you know, national news, and Sheila Nevins took offense at that. She said, this is a national story, and I think there's something there, and I think you know, let's explore this together.
Were you there to pitch something else, or were you there just for a regular meeting of some other agenda?
We were just talking about projects, but we were talking about terrorism, and Sheila's point, which is really the point of the film, is that what happens to the survivors, what happened to all those who were injured, and the victims' families in the aftermath, and I think, you know, there's always, when something like this happens, there's a media blitz, and there was a lot of international press about what happened, but then everyone went away. And what Annie and I found is that the local newspaper, the Boston Globe, really stayed there with the stories, and it was through their work that we were able to learn about Jessica and Patrick in a much more intimate way than had they not followed it. So we ended up partnering with HBO and the Boston Globe to make the film.
So you two, yeah, let's get you.
So Patrick
into the
and,
fold.
And Jessica,
your story was you were
not running in the marathon. No. You were just spectators.
Correct. No runners were hurt significantly. The bombs were in the crowd, tightly packed with families and loved ones, and the bombs were put on the ground. So we were at the first bomb site, and we are just two of the many people that were hurt. I think over almost 300 injuries. There are 17 amputees. Three people passed away that day, and then a fourth also was killed by the attackers.
Now, are you both from the Boston area, or did you go up specially to watch the marathon?
So I'm from Northern California. I married a Bostonian, technically.
Cantabrigian.
Yeah, it's his favorite word.
The People's Republic of Cambridge. You ever heard of it?
My daughter just graduated Brandeis, so I've spent a lot of time over the last 4 years in the Boston area, and I love the Boston area.
And I did too, even as an outsider, and our next life plans, Patrick had a fellowship in Northern California, and we were about to move. And we thought, we don't know when we'll be back for another Boston Marathon, and it's such a...
So this is something you guys had both done before, like gone and seen the marathon, or you had?
We both ran in 2005. We didn't know each other at the time.
At the Boston Marathon.
Yes, sir. Yeah. I was a senior at Boston College. Jess was running with a friend.
I was a bandit. I want to make that clear.
Who had a better time?
Way, not even close.
Like an hour or two. It was, It's just smoking.
Embarrassing.
Look,
yeah.
We should say right now that people who aren't sitting with us here don't know you are an amputee. You were one of the survivors that we're talking about today.
Yes.
And tell us exactly
what. So is my husband. He's hiding it. We both lost our left legs that day, the day the bombs went off. And then I proceeded to try to save my right leg for about a year and a half. And didn't work out. So I'm now a bilateral below knee amputee, and my husband is a single below knee amputee, and we were newly married. This was our newlywed year, which, you know, people said was going to be tough.
Is it that sense of humor that's helped you come through some of this?
I mean,
that's remarkable.
I'm sitting here, I'm like in awe of you guys. It's remarkable. And you're walking, I should say, because again, we don't have a camera filming this.
Right.
You have an assist dog.
Yes.
But you're not walking on with a cane or
no,
or anything.
No, and I'm also not walking comfortably, and I'm also in between surgeries. And so I can hide a lot behind jokes and a smile and a dress. And so it's definitely not over for us and our family.
So you walked in here, though. What is the function of a service dog for you?
Oh, my God. Well, I don't even know where to begin. I mean, that's a whole nother interview. I mean, I was physically, he can do a lot of tasks for me, most of which are helpful when my legs are not on, which is typically when I'm home.
I see.
So you get in bed, you forgot to turn the lights off. You don't have to get out. You don't have your legs on, and neither does your husband. So we call our service dog. He can bring me my phone. He can fetch my keys if I drop them. He can open doors. I mean, there's a whole long list of things that he was trained to physically help us with, but what we weren't expecting was how much he helped us with our emotional recovery. I slept through the night for the first time when we got him. We laughed again. I mean, when you have an animal in the house, there's usually a lot of playfulness and laughter. So rescue is like a whole nother big part of our life and has just really been a gift.
You know, I'm from
he has his own Instagram page,
yeah.
By the way.
Really?
Shameless plug coming.
At Rescue Boston. Can follow all his events. He tweets all the time at dinner.
Well, look for that to double or triple after this.
He also has
this.
An upcoming book.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got a book coming out. He's a little opinionated
about
the...
listening to this, they can see the dog at what's the Instagram page?
It's at Rescue Boston.
Do you guys have an Instagram
no,
page?
No, just Rescue.
You know, I'm from the Boston area, and one thing I know we're proud of there are the hospitals. Can you tell me about them?
Absolutely. I mean, we were hurt in the mecca of medicine, Boston. Within a stone's throw were some of the best hospitals, not only in our country, but in the world. And if not for the proximity and for their expertise, and frankly, by some strokes of great luck. We were at the finish line, so there was EMTs and ambulances waiting to take care of runners. They weren't prepared to take care of a blast, but they made do with what they had. And then they were able to get us to hospitals within minutes. And then it also happened at a time of day that shift was changing. So nurses and docs who were about to leave for the day stayed on, and they had a whole wave of new shift coming in, so they doubled their staffing just as we were arriving at their hospital. Not to mention a great dear friend of ours, doctor, rode to the hospital in a pedicab. Other people had run the marathon and then ran the rest of the way to their hospital because they knew the city needed them, and they responded.
And we're seeing a lot of that in this film, obviously.
Yes, the filmmakers again, to Ricky and Annie. First of all, the movie will be on HBO. When will it be on?
The film has its broadcast premiere on HBO on November 21st, but we're doing a bunch of screenings between now and then, in particular a very big event up in Boston on November 15th and another one in New York on the 14th. And we'll open theatrically in theaters in L.A. and New York.
I know that you're saying the focus of the documentary is on what the survivor story and what happens. Are you able, I mean, I know that it's a very well-documented event, but is there any footage of the personal journey that they took, you know, right after the bombing?
Absolutely.
Is there really?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was, yes, the film does show what happened that day, and it was really important. In fact, I think Jessica said to us that it's important for people to know what it looks like to be blown up by a bomb, because, you know, it's reality, and so that was important without, you know, making it you know, unnecessarily so, but we wanted to show the reality of their experience. And then there were so many iPhone videos of their recovery and photographs and, you know, family being there with them, that we have a lot of documentation, photographs and radio interviews that really tell their story for the 3 years after the bombing. And as I said before, the Boston Globe, because they were there, the photographers were there, they stayed with them. The reporter, Eric Moskowitz, became a good friend of theirs. We got his radio files. They were incredibly generous, also, the reporters.
Licensing, all of that was not difficult, and you got a lot of their photographs.
Well, in doing a partnership with the Boston Globe, we basically did a blanket license deal with them for this film, where they partnered with us on it. But to Ricky's point, I mean, it was incredible how the reporters, who really maintained long-term relationships and coverage of some of the survivors and how they were doing. I mean, they really opened up their sort of archival vaults and shared them with us, which was really incredibly helpful.
You know, this happened, and what made you at that particular point allow filmmakers to, I mean, obviously, I would think it would be something that would, on your mind,
yeah,
not be like,
question.
Not be like,
how'd they talk
okay,
you
during this whole time where you have to, yeah. you know, you're all messed up mentally and physically, and it's like, sure, come on in and let, you know, how do you make that decision to, like,
right.
sure, film your recovery over the...
Well, it was a really hard decision, and one of the many hard decisions that Patrick and I have had to make together, right? Because we're kind of a package deal now for everything. When you're married and blown up together... So sometimes he's on board with something and I'm not, or vice versa. But I think the story always felt so important to tell, as much as I desperately wished it wasn't my life, if that makes any sense. I still cannot believe that it's me on the screen and my husband on the screen. And it is. We put a lot out there. I think everyone who's in the film was incredibly generous with their privacy and showed a lot of really ugly moments, you know?
You wanted other people to see the...
I think it's important to see the aftermath of something of this.
Final question.
Level.
Will you run again? Will
I'd like your take on that as well. I know your package deal, but it's the same
no,
answer.
No, that's my side.
No, I
yeah, what made you allow cameras to come into, you know, your lives?
We went back and forth on it for a while. And even during the process of it, we had times where we were like, we're done. This is real. It's a lot of work. It takes a lot of energy in the midst of arranging surgeries and physical therapies and going to the grocery store and to have people come in. You know, it takes a lot of energy on our part. But we really do believe that these are stories that need to be told over a long period of time so that the public has an appreciation for what it is that not just what we go through, but the people in Orlando are going through, the people in San Bernardino, the people in Paris, the people in Brussels, that this is, we are but an example of how this has occurred many times over before Boston and after Boston.
Do you think at all about going to public events now? Do you think about them differently?
I like when I see a parade, a race on TV, and I see that really packed, condensed crowd, it definitely comes back to mind. But it's more when we're out publicly, it's about how we're navigating the world with our new medical equipment, our prosthetics, our dog. People are, you know, really, they're like blown away about what they're seeing as we're walking down the street. And so sometimes we're focusing so much on walking, but people want to say hi to rescue, or they want to, so what the hell are those things on the ends of your legs propelling you down the sidewalk? And
Do strange people come up to you and actually ask you?
Oh,
this?
We've had conversations with.
How rude.
Well, sometimes it does come.
You're letting us talk to you, but others, it
yeah,
seems
you,
wrong.
Well, you guys are just kind of rude by nature, and we knew that coming in.
Yeah, sorry.
That, some people are rude, some people are just very thoughtful and curious. Some people just want to give you a wink and a thumbs up to let you know that they are supporting you. Kids are wonderfully curious. They come up and they're so fascinated by rescue and what he does for us, and they want to hold our leg and touch our leg. And we've really found that to be very healing for us to do that with children, because once you talk about it, once they touch it, it's demystified. And then all of a sudden they see you as people, not just as Some sort of freak show.
Well, this has been an amazing conversation.
Yeah, really,
I mean,
amazing.
We meet lots of people at film festivals, and nothing is, even approaches this. So we thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Joining us and the filmmakers as well. HBO is a great place for documentaries. It always has been. That competition, as we've talked about earlier, is heating up a little with other people buying docs. But HBO still seems to lead the sets the bar very high, and we will watch for the film on November 21st.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for speaking with us.
Ladies. This year is kind of a hotbed for docs. We're meeting so many documentary filmmakers, and these are first-time doc makers. They are Daniel Mehrar. It's so easy. I try and make it difficult.
It's like Brian Lehrer.
Yeah. And your slick sidekick doesn't have a name tag, so he's going to have to...
Andrew Becker.
Andrew. You're so GQ looking.
Oh, wow, like, thank you.
And you co-directed this thing?
Correct.
Yes.
And what drew you... First of all, give us the rundown. What's it about, basically?
The story's about a woman that lives in a very small rural town in northwestern Spain. In this village, there's only one other family that lives there, and she's convinced that family is responsible for her husband's disappearance.
This is fascinating. How did you? I mean, that's like a Dateline. That's like a. I feel
hopefully
like
a little bit better than Dateline. Yeah.
It was a mystery, or was it? You know, it's like one of those things that guy does.
Yeah, exactly.
How did you find the story?
So we found this story because this couple who lives in this, or the couple who lived in this village, they had an organic farm that took volunteers to help work on the farm. My brother happened to be traveling in Spain and picked this village and this place to volunteer at, and he arrived the day that this man never made it back.
Is two families technically a town?
Well,
I mean, basically the five, that's what, seven people? It was like, yeah. How many people?
Yeah, it was, Margo, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, it was about five.
And the husband disappears.
Correct.
And where do we join the? Where do we pick it up in the narrative? Where do we jump into the story?
So the man's name who disappeared is Martin Verfonderen. He disappeared in 2010. We started shooting in 2013. But you know, we go back and we trace Martin and his widow Margot's journey. They grew. They lived in right outside of Amsterdam. Sort of left the city life behind. Went on a journey through Europe for 2 years and just kind of stumbled across this village in Spain. They're like, let's just set up shop here. And
how hard is it to get a distributor? Do you shop it around?
It's impossible. You have anybody interested?
I mean, you're at the festival. You know, we do a lot of festivals, yeah. And there's so many films at the festivals, and then
sure.
So few of those actually get distribution deals.
That's depressing.
How do you go about doing it? I mean, you spend
no
all
idea.
This time making
yeah.
them.
That's why they're here.
I mean, yeah, right. to be honest, you know, when we made this, we just wanted to make a film. We really have no idea how this process works, which is not the best position to be in. But as, you know, I think we're happy with how the film came out, and people seem to be responding to it, and we're getting into some festivals. And so now we're literally just learning.
I just want to point out that if you had done this before and were maybe more experienced at it, the publicist that you brought would be holding an umbrella over you guys instead of Neil Rosen.
Oh, actually,
because it's just started to drizzle just a bit.
Yeah, I grew up watching Neil Rosen.
Did you really?
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about that.
I was, that's much more interesting.
I remember like the mustache days.
Oh my God, you did really want. That was like 12 years ago. Wow, that's amazing. That's interesting.
So is this the premiere? Is this the first festival it's been at?
Ah, we screened it at the Edinburgh Film Festival. In June.
And, you know, was it hard filming in that particular, shooting in that particular location? Were there any restrictions?
There are challenges, but you get asked that question sometimes, but I think it'd be like, I think it'd be disrespectful to say it was hard to so many other filmmakers that do, that create things in much harsher environments than we were.
And where does the, what, so do we have a launch schedule for this at all? I mean, is there a VOD plan, or is there? So you're here literally going, hey, who wants to buy this? We're here.
We would ask that question to somebody if we knew who that
was. Yeah,
so if you knew who they are,
you could point them,
we'll ask them.
Point them in a direction.
So literally tomorrow at this time, we may be able to report that you've sold it.
I mean, that would be ideal.
Monday at the latest. Let's go crazy. Let's give it 48 hours.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, good luck, guys. Congratulations, and welcome to the world of...
Cognac?
No, it's...
Bill Bergoglio has a question for you, don't you? No?
It's grappa.
Sorry,
I'm just sniffing it.
I'm good. When they were shooting.
What's that?
They had to do farming when they were there.
You had to work?
Yeah, so I think our first trip there, Margot was, you know, wanted to kind of put us through the normal routine. So we would shoot with her, then we would like plant potatoes or shovel, you know, goat shit for hours, and then go back to filming with her until she sort of like realized that we would be willing to put the effort in.
And it's safe to assume that there's a surprise or there's something revealed in this film about.
I think there's a twist. Actually, there's a couple good twists in there, I think.
Like Law and Order, you won't see them coming.
Exactly like on Law and Order. Actually, the last part of the movie is just a Law and Order episode. We just cut it in. That's the twist.
Yeah. The ching-ching.
But it's edited really well. You won't even notice.
Yeah. Okay, well, we wish you luck with the film.
Yeah, we want to see it. I'm being sincere.
Wish you luck with
that. Sounds cool.
That would be great.
Getting a distribution deal, yeah. You know, we got our fingers crossed for you. It is tough, though, isn't it, really, isn't it?
Thus far.
Yeah. Well, again, it's tough.
Well, you were at a great film festival, and hopefully, you'll get something.
Yeah, yeah.
As we pointed out, more and more people are buying docs today. The market is wide open.
Right.
We review lots of them.
Netflix and Hulu and Amazon. Yeah. And there's a lot more avenues now than there've ever been before.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, yeah, I hope some people come out. And
this is a good festival for international films. I mean,
yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, and we're in the world, well, you know, because it's essentially, it's basically a foreign film. We're in the world cinema section of it, of documentary world cinema. So.
Right.
There's a lot of great films.
Have you guys ever been out to the Hamptons before?
I never have. He has.
I have. Well, I grew up in New York City, so I would come out to Montauk a little bit as a kid.
It's a beautiful setting.
Except for the rain, how do you feel?
I feel great. The rain is reinvigorating. Yeah. I think it's awesome.
It's almost like a spa. It's a mist. It's not even really rain. It's just kind of like Evian being sprinkled on us.
In a mist
tent
or something.
Premier publicist here working for you, Eric Vatt, my friend for many years.
Oh, you guys are homies?
Oh, yeah. Nice. Absolutely.
He watches New York One, too. So that's the three of you.
Yeah.
All right.
It's tough with the Roku these days.
Good luck to you guys.
Yeah, good luck, guys. Thanks for joining us.
All right, we're here with the one and only Robert Davi. Tell us about the movie.
Well, it's called Davi's Way, and it came about because of my friendship with a terrific young actor, producer, entrepreneur, Danny A., who I did a film with called The Iceman, and we became friends on that film. That was with Michael Shannon and Ray Liotta and Franco. And
great, terrific film. Underrated movie.
Yeah.
And Michael's unbelievable in that.
Yeah, he's great in it. He's great. It's a really Ariel Varman directed. Anyway, so we became friends on that, and he started coming to see my concerts. I did an album in 2011 that Phil Ramone produced.
The late Phil Ramone,
who
all the people don't know, produced many, including
all of Billy Joel,
the whole Billy Joel catalog,
most of Billy
Stranger on.
Yeah,
you know, basically. You know?
Yeah,
yeah. I've met Phil. Yeah, he's a
gentleman. What a gentleman.
So what kind? You were doing Sinatra kind of stuff, or
so? What happened was. I mean, the whole genesis of things. I mean, you want to hear the whole genesis?
Sure.
Of
we love it.
We're here.
I mean, because otherwise, you know.
We got a whole festival to fill.
Okay.
By the way, welcome to the Hamptons.
Thank you.
Have you ever been in the Hamptons before?
Really? My mother was born in the Hamptons.
What
Hampton? 1921. Southampton. Off of Job's Lane. That was my grandfather, who came from Naples, her father, Stefano Rullo, went from the coal mines of Pennsylvania, then railroad building. He wound up in the Hamptons.
That's pretty much the way it goes.
And he was a
railroad coal mine, Southampton.
Yeah, but here's this. Here's where it doesn't go. Bootlegger, his partners were Marshall Field and Joseph P. Kennedy.
Marshall Field, the department store.
The department store. And Joseph P. Kennedy. My grandfather, those were friends of his.
Well, we knew Kennedy ran.
Yeah. But
Hooch,
my grandfather.
But we had no idea Marshall Field.
He was the go-between, supposedly, between them and other people.
So technically mobbed up, when you say other people.
You know,
so
technically, not when I knew him. This was in the 20s and early 30s.
This isn't a Senate investigation.
Well, let me tell you, I refuse to answer on the grounds of maker. No.
So but did you come out to the Hamptons as a kid?
Yeah, we went to Sag Harbor in the Hamptons. I grew up in Dix Hills, but we still had family over here.
So Sag Harbor back then, now it's a little she-she. It was probably hardware stores and butcher stores.
It was potato.
Where was the CVS drugstore then?
I don't think there were. But anyway, so I had the roots of the Hamptons. So having the film premiere here is kind of like, you know, it's kind of interesting.
And the affection to Sinatra. Where did
in an
the
Italian
very, give us the very first day that
probably
happened.
In utero. Yeah. To be honest with you, because you got to realize, in an Italian family, there were two figures, the Pope and Sinatra, and not necessarily in that order.
And Sinatra was in the room when you were delivered?
Well, probably being played somewhere.
So you were telling us the genesis of the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, this is the genesis, the genesis of. So because Sinatra was such a huge figure in an Italian immigrant family, because he was the first artist to come out against anti-Semitism and racial bigotry, he also gave the Italian immigrant an identity they hadn't had before. So you have to understand that
not
as a
really
young actor...
Joe DiMaggio or...
Sinatra was primary.
Okay.
Because it was the art. It was DiMaggio, also Bennett. But Sinatra was the biggest figure for an Italian immigrant family from the 40s and 50s and 60s. That was it. Because the other guys didn't touch racial bigotry or anti-Semitism the way he did back then. He was a champion. And he was a champion for the Italian immigrant and giving them a certain dignity, like I said, that they hadn't had before. As big as the contribution as the others had, Sinatra was the apex of that.
So you were singing Sinatra?
No, I was singing opera.
Okay.
As a young kid, my love was opera. I won awards, first place New York State.
I didn't know that.
Baritone.
Like Sorvino.
Well, different. I studied in Italy. I won Metropolitan Opera auditions of the... I mean, I was... a major potential opera singer.
No kidding.
At the same time winning awards for acting. This is as a kid.
Then you had an injury and you couldn't play anymore?
No, I got sick.
Really?
I got sick.
Oh,
I got
and
a cure.
Something happened?
No, two things happened to me. If you really want to go into this.
Yeah, yeah.
At 16, I was playing football. Weeb Eubank came to watch me play. They wanted to draft me for the Jets because I played for Seton Hall High School in Patchogue. I was winning awards for the singing and the acting. I got ill right after junior year in football. Dying. I got a cure from Padre Pio. That's another show that we'll talk about.
Well, what'd you have?
I have no idea what I had.
Okay.
Really?
Till today, they had no idea what I had, but friends of ours knew Padre Pio and San Giovanni Rotondo, Foggia, Italy, which I just made a tribute, pilgrimage to Petrocino and San Giovanni Rotondo. Anyway, that's another story. So that put me on the artistic path. Okay?
Uh-huh.
Hence the acting. 1977, I do my first film with Frank Sinatra. Became friends with Sinatra.
What was that film?
Contract on Cherry Street. Me and
okay. That was an NBC made-for-TV movie.
Made-for-TV movie.
And Sinatra guest hosted the Tonight Show one night to promote. I remember watching to promote. And at the end of it, it was a 90-minute show back then.
Yes.
And he goes at the end, Contract on Cherry Street. He's like ordering me.
Watch it.
Like, what? Yeah. Watch it. Or you're like in trouble, basically.
My guys will come over.
Right, he was a cop or something like that.
Yeah, a detective.
I remember. NBC made-for-TV movie. Yeah, absolutely.
And I shouldn't have been in that film. The odd part about all of this, if you look at it, is, and you think of 1977, is how many years from today?
Almost 30 years ago. Almost 40 years ago.
My mother died right after we finished that film. She died young, in the 50s, mid-50s. Now... my agent at the time in New York, and I had gotten a scholarship to Hofstra University, my agent in New York had said they put me up for the film, but Sinatra was using all his friends. I says, where's Columbia Pictures? He goes, Fifth Avenue. I says, I'm going to go up there. He goes, what do you have to lose?
I love this story.
So I go up to Columbia Pictures. Now, today, the guards would stop you at the door.
Right, 711 Fifth Avenue.
Right.
Absolutely.
So I go there. They say, third floor. I go, Cherry Street. Can I go up? He says, go ahead. The guard. Two women, one's on the desk, one's behind the desk. I says, I understand you're casting Cherry Street. I was told it's all cast. First they said, can you help me? They said, well, no, not quite. Do you have a picture and resume? I says, I didn't want to be presumptuous. I said, but I decided to come up. They said, bring one tomorrow morning. Right then, I said, there's my opening. Screw that. I went right to the agent, got the picture and resume, came back 10 minutes later. Guard says, go ahead. Now, a different behind the desk. I give them this picture and resume. They laugh. I go, why wait? I get a phone call. You know, back then you had to have like a pocket full of quarters.
Right, right.
You know, your pants would get holes in the pockets because of
the service.
Actiphone.
Yeah, service.
You had to call Actiphone. Any messages, right? Three times a day.
Grand Central, the long bank of phones. Sure.
So I call up at 10 o'clock in the morning, 11:30, 11 o'clock. They said, Columbia called. Call them right away. I call up. This is the next day, don't forget. This is on a Friday morning. I went on a Thursday. Come to Columbia right away. We want you to pick up a script. I go there. They give me a script. They go read these scenes. Come back at 6 o'clock. I come back at 6 o'clock at night. And now, you know how actors, you linger after an audition sometimes. You want to wait for them. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of things going through your head. Well, the door opens up immediately, and they go, don't leave yet.
Ah.
That could mean two things. They want to see something else, or they have other news. She comes out, and she says, it's 99% yours.
Ah.
So I get the film. They call up Monday. They make the deal. And for 3 months with Sinatra, became friends with him. My mom passed away. By the time we finished in September, she passed
Where'd
away.
You shoot?
In Manhattan.
So little, Patsy's every night for dinner?
We were Patsy's or Patsy's Pizza, Patsy's on West 54th Street.
Right.
Downtown, at, I won't mention some of the places. We shot on Cherry Street. 2 o'clock in the morning, we're in Cherry Street at a social club. I'm sitting there, like, standing against the radiator, 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'm thinking, I'm on my first film with Sinatra. And Sinatra's at the bar with Martin Gables, who's married to Arlene Francis.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Great actor, Martin Gables, yeah, yeah. Right? Harry Guardino, Jilly Rizzo, and some other gentlemen that will go unnamed. And he does a double take. He sees me out of the corner. He goes, Robert, have a drink. I don't drink, Mr. Sinatra. You don't drink, you're fired. I'll have what you're having. Get over here. He puts out the bottle of Jack
That
Daniels.
Wasn't true that you weren't a drinker.
No, it was
oh,
true.
Okay.
It was true. I don't drink.
Oh.
So I gave me my first Jack Daniels.
Oh, my God.
With Sinatra. Mm. And five rehabs later, I'm still drinking. No, I'm kidding about the rehabs. But
did Jilly have a place on 58th Street then, near
Jilly
the plaza?
Jilly had 77, yeah. He still had...
The little like,
he
club.
Had a place on 58th,
I thought.
58th,
yeah, right 58th. Near the plaza.
Was Jilly's.
Yeah.
Nice. And then he had another joint.
Do you sing Sinatra stuff in the movie?
There's some stuff in it, yeah. Anyway... Phil, I do a demo at Capitol Records of four songs in 2011 because I feel that the country is fraying, music is fraying. The Great American Songbook is the Shakespeare of America. It's the amalgam of the American experience. And in the show, I just didn't want to sing. I wanted to also remind the country of his contribution in terms of anti-Semitism, racial bigotry, and that the songbook is the amalgam of the American experience. It comes from the black jazz and jump blues artists. It comes from the Welsh, Irish, Scottish, English, American, Indian, Lebanese, who've been here since the Revolutionary War, and a large portion from the sons and daughters of Jewish immigrants. So you could say without the Jews, there would be no great American songbook. Because there had been an anti-Semitism around the world coming up again. I knew this. I've traveled all over the world, even with the United Nations. I mean, I've been on my own. 5,000 people in Estonia, Latvia, Sweden, Budapest, Italy, Australia, China with the UN, at the General Assembly. I just sang for the Prime Minister of Bangladesh at the United Nations.
What are you singing? What kind of stuff are you singing?
The songbook, the American songbook. Some of the Sinatra tunes and some obscure stuff.
Cole Porter, Irving Berlin.
Erwin Drake.
But the mission of the movie.
Gershwin, Simi Khan, Jimmy Van Heusen.
The mission of the film is to take the Sinatra, to replicate the Sinatra show, correct?
Yeah, so Danny A.
Main event at the Garden.
Danny A. sees this show.
70? When was it?
74.
Okay, another
off. Sinatra does the main event, and I remember that. Remember?
Was he still good?
Yeah.
He opened up.
He wasn't using the big cards and.
But he
and
opened
reading
up. With,
no,
he opened up with okay. Pennies from Heaven.
You know, I forget what he opened with.
What do you think the best Sinatra period of recording is? I personally, I like the Capitol years.
Everyone. I mean, the '60s, the sound of the Capitol years, the warmth of the voice.
Those Nelson Riddle arrangements.
And the arrangements. And Axel, well, also Gordon Jenkins.
I mean,
and Axel stored all the strings Axel of Axel. That he knew Axel in the 40s, you know. Mm. You know, Axel worked with Tommy Dorsey. That's how he met him. I mean, when you go into this deep, deep world of these guys, the
right.
guys he knew, these artists that were just the amazing.
But Dorsey was the guy that wouldn't let him go, right?
Amazing.
Was Dorsey the guy that wouldn't let him go, or was that Harry James?
Yeah, that
James?
Was Dorsey. No, yeah. Harry James let him go. Harry James was a gentleman. Tommy Dorsey was the guy. But anyway, so my idea was to do this wonderful big tribute at Madison Square Garden. And Phil Ramone had passed away because he was going to be key to getting some other talent to that. And Danny A., who I had given, I wrote a script about this older guy that wanted, was obsessed with Sinatra's voice. He said, let's do a documentary. So Danny said, let's do the, and he put the documentary together, got Creative Chaos, Tom Donahue, and Elon, his partner, and then gave me an assistant, Stevie Gutman, and it became this potpourri of this journey that doesn't quite, well, you have to see the film. Have you seen it yet?
No, we'll go.
We're going to see tonight?
We don't think
goes
as planned. I don't know. That's
yeah, it doesn't go as planned. And I didn't want to be, look, and I
but you're obviously okay with that. I mean, you're like.
You know what? Look, here's the thing. I could have done something and demanded this and demanded that and wanted myself saccharinized. That wouldn't be the, it wouldn't be interesting and it wouldn't be the truth.
Okay.
I'm known as a tough guy, so who cares?
Well, you play tight and die hard. You're always playing a tough guy.
Well, I did Profiler where I was the good guy, you know. Edgy, but still good. So in this film here...
Bond villain. Come on.
Well, License to Kill, of
course.
That's
right.
So I didn't mind showing the
nice side, the warm side.
Well, there is warmth, but there's also me being... when you see the film, I don't want to give away too much, but you'll see that I have my frustration in life. As an actor, I have made compromises, and I didn't want to do that with the music. So that's where some of the...
All right, fair enough.
So is Robert going to honor us with a couple of bars? Someday.
Great song.
When I'm awfully...
Apparently you're on your own with that one, Neil.
So the movie is called...
Dobby's Way.
And it looks at...
And East Hampton is your kind of town this weekend.
My kind of town, to put it in
Sinatra terms.
Well, I always love coming to the Hamptons. How can you not love the Hamptons?
Well, we love it, too. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, guys.
Have you.
Thank
really,
you, gentlemen.
Really, it's a pleasure to have
Ring
you.
Ring a ding. It felt like we went back to...
Does the movie have a distributor yet?
Oh, yeah.
They're already calling. Yeah, they're calling. So we'll see what happens. You know, I'm anxious for you to see it.
I'm very anxious to see it. So for Bill McCuddy.
That's me.
And Bill Bregoli.
There I am.
And Neil Rosen at the 24th annual Hampton International Film Festival.
Will there be a part three, Neil?
No, I think that's it. But next year we'll be back.
You know what they say about sequels.
Anyway, our regular podcast next week. And thanks for sitting around talking movies with us. We'll be sitting around talking movies with you again next week. Thanks for joining us.